Michael Nicholson, Reel 5. Yes, you were saying about, you know, getting film out and having worked so hard to get your stories.
Yes. I mean, I think one of the best definitions of being a television reporter is that it's 10% talent and 90% logistics. And trying to get into a country and trying to get to the story, and then once you've got your story, trying to get it out again, back to base, is the major part of our employment. Covering the story itself is the easiest thing in the world. I mean, when things are happening around you, all you've got to do is point a camera and report what you see. There's no great secret about that. There's no great talent involved. But I think Sandy Gore once paid me a great compliment saying that he always admired the way I could get into a place and get out of it quicker than anybody else. And that certainly has been, I suppose, if you'll excuse a bit of trumpet blowing, one of my great talents is that I managed to quite often beat people into a story, and then, having done it, got out quickly and got it transmitted. There have been some, you know, famous scoops in that way, and we'll probably deal with them later on. So that's always, I suppose, if you say what did I learn from Nigeria, maybe the one of the things I did learn was the ability to move very, very fast and in unexpected ways.
Did you do any interviews with the sort of Nigerian high-ups, or Biafran as well?
No. No, I met Gohan, but never interviewed him. That wasn't my job. You see, I was going back to about getting in and out of places. The trade definition for the kind of job I've been doing so much of my life is a fireman. They call you a fireman. You know, you go to the fire, and you actually don't put it up, but you get to the fire first. And there have been some, I may have told you, during the Bangladeshi floods, did we cover that, the floods in Bangladesh, and the man with the flying boat? I mean, that's one good example of it. The other example, two famous examples, was Cyprus and Jordan, where we not only got to the story, nobody else got to, but also we got it out in the right time frame. You see, in those days, and I'm going back, say, 30 years now, if you left London on a Monday morning to go to, say, India, where you would arrive on a Tuesday, if you were very lucky, if you arrived in the morning, you could cover that story by Tuesday evening. And you would ship it, and it could be in London by Wednesday, if you were lucky. If you moved as fast as you could possibly move and had all the luck in the world, leaving London on a Monday morning, you could probably have that story on the screen by Wednesday evening. And that was considered lightning coverage. Now, today, if a story happens on a Monday and it's not transmitted till a Wednesday, that's history. I mean, history is made in seconds, minutes, exaggerating, but minutes. What happens in an earthquake in Turkey or in India or wherever has to be on the screen within an hour of it happening, or a few hours of it happening. You know, the floods, the earthquakes we've had recently have all been on air the same day. That couldn't possibly have happened in the old days, but with the extension of agency coverage now, agencies have their camera in all over the world. They never used to have them in that way. And with satellite transmission, news is news. It happens now. And it's shown very soon after now. Well, in my days, when I was starting, you had 3 or 4 days to cover a story. And, of course, you didn't have the telephones that you have today. Nowadays, my producers are anywhere in the world. They can contact London just by touch dial. I was up in the North Pole last year, literally standing on what was considered to be the North Pole, according to the GPS. And an hour or so later, I was transmitting that footage to London via the satellite from a base just south of the North Pole. people often ask me what the great, you know, the great improvements have been, whether they're improvements, certainly developments, and that is the technology that's been introduced over the last 30 years for us. It's made our job easier in many ways, but also much, much harder, because you're in constant touch, you're in constant demand. And I think one misses the luxury of time to think and write and appraise, you know, evaluate something. I think that's the fault of so many of the kids today. You know, we blame them for their slightly down-market, lightweight reports, but they don't have much time to think about them. I mean, I can actually, I've often had the luxury of sitting down in a hotel room for half a day thinking about a story and writing it. And then people say, what a wonderful commentary that was. Well, I had time to do it. Nowadays, kids have got to, you know, rush in front of a live camera only just having just stepped off an airplane. Very hard to blame them. You blame the system. Years ago, when CBS and NBC and ABC were covering the White House, press conferences, before the satellite was introduced, you know, they had time to leave the press conference, write their pieces, think about what the president had said, and make them evaluate their own opinion, write it, and then send it to New York over the landline. But then it was introduced live television, satellite television, and they used to rush out of the press conferences and jump in front of the camera, and they got it wrong so often that all three nets agreed that there would be a moratorium of, say, 5 or 6 minutes between the end of the press conference to the start of their broadcast, in order to try and get it as right as often as possible. I'm afraid that doesn't exist anymore now. I mean, it's the first one. It doesn't matter whether you're right or wrong. It's the first one on air that matters. So we had the luxury of time. They don't have the apprenticeship either. You see, my apprenticeship was a very slow and quite long one. I mean, I joined ITN in 64. Well, I didn't actually start reporting until about 66, 67, and then in a very small way. So you were trained very slowly how to write a script, how to present it, how to record it, how to, you know, do interviews. You learnt them from the crews, as I said before. But nowadays, you know, you've got a pretty face and poof, you're straight in front of the camera, you know.
So you're reporting for Biafra, you know, when you returned to ITN, was that appreciated? You know, this was your first big job abroad, I think.
Nigeria, Biafra, my first big stories.
Yes. How did the vets, you know, regard this? What was their attitude for the work you'd done? Were they appreciative, or did you get any?
Oh, you know, I quite forget. I imagine they were. It doesn't last long, you know. The memory is very short in news, especially among the suits. You know, you get your herogram. There is a saying, you're as good as your last story. And if you do something wrong, as we all know, it's like all trades, you do something wrong and people seem to have a very long memory about it. Do something really great and the memory is a very short memory. But, you know, so what?
But did this enhance your reputation?
I think, yes. People often ask, how did you become a foreign correspondent? Well, you know, you don't take a degree in it. You don't take a diploma in it. It happens by accident. You have to want it to happen, of course. And I've spent many, many months, maybe even years, you know, sitting longingly at the home desk, looking at foreign correspondents hovering about the foreign desk on their way out to some, you know, exotic place or dangerous place, exciting place. And feeling sick with envy, literally feeling sick inside with envy, until that one day when, like in Nigeria, there seemed to be nobody else around or nobody else wanted to go, and there's Nicholson, send him, you know, can't do any harm, he might do a bit of good. And once you've done well, as I did then, and in Biafra as I did then, it becomes a knee-jerk reaction, you know, oh, Nicholson did well last time, yes, send him, yes, that sounds a good bet. And little by little by little, you build up your reputation. But of course, what's always uppermost in your mind on the flight out to somewhere is that this could be the last time. Not because you're going to get killed. That's never occurred to me. But this time you could muck it up. There is always, I think James Cameron perfectly summed it up. He said that every time, and you know, he was the veteran of all veterans. He said that every time he went on a story, even towards the end of his career, he thought, ah, now this is the one that I'm going to muck up. This time, they'll find out that I'm a real sham. You know, that it's all been a sham, and that terrible suspicion is always in your mind. It makes you slightly paranoid. But then I think most journalists are paranoids anyway. In many ways, you have to be paranoid to do the job. But that's always uppermost in your mind, especially when you're young and starting with, well, you've had a good run of luck and now it's just about to run out, and what a shame, you know. But somehow I kept the luck and kept the run.
So where was your next job after Biafra, your job abroad? Would that have been Jordan?
I think it must have been Jordan. There must have been a gap, mustn't there, between the end of Biafra, which, if I remember, is end of 69, wasn't it, to June 1970, when... The Palestinians were playing hell in Jordan. They'd been given sanctuary by King Hussein, but as has happened with so many other countries after that, once the Palestinians had moved in, they attempted to dictate their own terms. They did it in Jordan, they did it in Beirut, in Lebanon. And I remember being sent to Amman, again, you know, still very much a fledgling foreign correspondent, and terribly excited by it all. And I got to London Airport, ready to check in, and there was a tannoy, would Nicholson of ITM please go to the information desk? I did. And it was my foreign editor, John Parker. And he said, look, we've just had some PA copy that the Palestinians, PFLP, George Habash, his group, which was opposed to the PLO, there were two factions then, and Habash's PFLP was by far the most militant and most terrorist of them all. And John said, look, we've got reports from PA that PFLP are kidnapping people en route from the Amman airport into the city. So, you know, my heart sank thinking that they were going to say, in that case, Michael, don't, you know, we're not going to send you. But he said quite the reverse, you know, off you go and, you know, keep your head down. Which I must say took me aback, and I've often thought since irresponsible foreign editors can be. Anyway, off I went, and as I left the Amman airport, you go through a series of tunnels, and my taxi was stopped, and I was hauled out at the point of an AK-47, which became a very familiar rifle to me in the years to come. And I was taken up to some little hideout up in the mountains, overlooking Amman. And there I was interrogated for quite a long time. I can still see the face of the man, huge, huge man with glasses, who was convinced that I was some kind of English spy. Kept saying, I know you, I've seen you before. Of course, I'd never seen him before. Well, they didn't torture me or anything like that. I mean, they never touched me other than, you know, drag me out of the car. But it was quite frightening for me because I'd never been through any kind of experience like this before or since. And it turned out that he knew me because he'd been, a law student or an economics student at the London School of Economics, which at the time was at the back of ITN in Kingsway. And he must have watched the news. And even though I was still a pretty young reporter, he probably somehow knew he'd seen me before because he'd seen ITN. But that hadn't occurred to him. He just thought that he had seen me because he had seen photographs of well-known or supposed British agents. Anyway, they kept me there for a day and a night, which was most unpleasant. And then they released me and dropped me off at a small hotel in a month called the Philadelphia. And there were lots of British holidaymakers there, some of whom have contacted me since, because what happened in the next few days and nights was so surreal, really surreal, that I found it hard to believe I'd gone through it afterwards, and people who wrote me letters, the holidaymakers I met, also wrote me letters saying, did it really happen to us? Because, just jumping ahead before I tell you the story, what happened to us was real enough, but because there were no newspaper reporters with us, it was never reported. And it bears out that wonderful old maxim in journalism that if a reporter's not there, it hasn't happened. Anyway, there must have been 20 or 30 British tourists, men, women and children, in the Philadelphia, and I was the only television correspondent there. There was an ABC cameraman, or a local cameraman with a small wind-up camera, and we were kept hostage by the PFLP. These were all young kids, all students, and all thoroughly enjoying themselves in a macabre way, bizarre way. Plenty of ammunition on them, and they'd ring the hotel with dynamite, and we could see the dynamite. Vast quantities of it, and they had given King Hussein an ultimatum, certain demands, of most of which I've forgotten now. Some among them was the release of certain of their members who were in prison, and if this ultimatum wasn't met, then they were going to blow up the hotel with all of us in it. And there was no doubt in my mind that they meant what they said. And yet these kids were treating it as if it was some kind of, you know, end of term ball. They put the records on, and they were dancing. They had these. The girls as well as boys there, and it just seemed not a nightmare, because it was, in a way, it was almost amusing to see all this happening when if the ultimatum wasn't met, you knew these people were perfectly capable of killing us all. Anyway, long story short, the King Hussein met some of these demands, and we woke up one morning, because we weren't allowed into our bedrooms, we all had to sleep down in the foyer lounge area, on the floor, where we could. And one morning, I think 2 days later, we all woke up to find that they had gone, and so had all the dynamite. So then I wanted the ABC cameraman to go out into the streets to film, you know, what there was to be seen, and he refused, because it was deathly quiet around us. So I borrowed his camera and went out and did a little bit of filming myself. And when I got back to London, they couldn't or wouldn't believe what I told them. You see, there was no way I could telephone them from the hotel. I simply jumped on a plane and came home. And the first reaction of my boss was, well, don't ever do that again. Don't leave a place unless you've got permission to leave it. But then when I related what I'd been through, I could see the disbelief. He thought, well, here's a young guy, inexperienced. He's obviously playing it for all it's worth. But every word that I wrote in my book about it is absolutely true. And if I wanted witnesses, you know, I could have provided them by the letters of people who later wrote to me, asking me whether they'd imagined it themselves. It does bear out that thing that if had there been a couple of newspaper reporters there, you see, they would have made it into a front page headline. But there was nothing for me to show. All I had was my word that it had happened, but they couldn't put me in front of a camera in the studio to relate it unless there were pictures, unless there was confirmation. So it was one of those. It was probably one of the most horrifying experiences that went totally unreported and unrecorded. So that's later, many years later, when I came across another scoop, one of the great coups, I suppose, I invited a journalist to share it with me because of that experience in Jordan. I thought, if I report this, who's going to believe me? The few scant pictures that I've got. I know it's true, my crew know it's true, but I need somebody else to confirm it. And so I told a guy called Fred Bridgeland, who worked for Reuters, about it, and I let him share my experiences, and he then, turned it into a newspaper story, which then everyone believed, which confirmed my story. So that's the kind of thing you're up against sometimes. Unless you've got pictures, it never happened. That's the problem of being a television correspondent. You always have to be there, and you always have to have the pictures. If you haven't, you might just as well not have travelled there in the first place.
I suppose the pictures you got afterwards would not have been incident.
There was such a feeling of terror that this cameraman would not leave the hotel. Nobody would. We can imagine having gone through those 2 days of living on the edge of what we were certainly edge of being annihilated, to poke your head out of a door, not knowing what was still in the streets. It was so quiet. So what does film of empty streets mean to anybody? Nothing.
But I suppose one has to remember the context of the time and the acts of terrorism that were going on. Is that right, Michael?
That's right. You see, it was I think... PLO, PFLP terrorism was the first of its kind that we experienced. They were using all kinds of devices. They were the suicide martyrs. They would board an aircraft. These were the days, remember, before, hard to believe nowadays, but this is before you were frisked going onto a plane, or your luggage was examined by X-ray. There was no such thing as air hijacking. But it was something that the Arabs introduced to us, of course. They would often send a man on board a plane with a grenade, and he would simply blow himself up and blow the plane up with it. There was a thing called the altitude bomb, which was terrifying. It was put into cargo luggage, and at a certain altitude, I think it was 10,000 feet, the bomb would go off and destroy the plane. And once we all knew about this, and it was kept a secret by the airlines for quite a long time, but we knew about it, I would be sweating, like my palms would be wet as we climbed out of airports, waiting to get beyond 10,000 feet, then I could relax and have my first gin and tonic. But it was a frightening thing. These were people who were quite prepared to kill themselves and everybody else, as they still are today, of course, all these years on. You get people blowing themselves up in order to kill another 30. And, of course, they go to paradise because of it. So it was very terrifying. But then later that year, of course, there was the momentous hijacking, the first of its kind, by Leila Khaled, another PFLP terrorist, young student, with a couple of other guys who tried to hijack a plane. I've quite forgotten what airline it was now. I think it was an American airline. It may have been Pan Am. But she was overpowered, arrested, and aircraft landed in London. And she was held. And because of that, the PFLP began a whole new wave of terrorism in order to get them released. This was the knock-on, you see. This is why it was always better not to take these people alive. And there was instances that we know of where a terrorist could have been taken alive, captured, but in fact was shot, because once you captured him and put him in prison, then there's another act of terrorism to get him released. And then if you arrest those people, and so it goes on, this ghastly domino effect. But Leila Khaled was held in London, and of course, what did the Arabs do then? What did the PFLP do? They hijacked four airliners, and they forced them to land in the desert, just outside Oman, about 20, 30 miles from Oman, at a place called Dawson's Field. That was named after. It was an old Royal Air Force desert strip for the Second World War, and I think it was named after the group captain who commanded that part. It was called Dawson's Field. And these aircraft were forced to land middle of the desert and kept there for days, sweltering heat, women and children on board, a lot of English school children going back to school, boarding schools. I remember them with little straw hats on, and one little boy had a tin with a terrapin in it. And the captain, the British Overseas Airways captain, BOAC captain at that time, was a very dour man, very phlegmatic man, who took it all in his stride. But again, they were going to blow these aircraft up with all the people on board if King Hussein didn't agree again to ultimatums, and if various Arab terrorists held in custody were not released. And that was the beginning of what we called, that happened in September, and the group that carried it all out became known as the Black September Group. Certain deals were made from Washington and London, as well as from Oman, and hostages were released. I went to the Intercon Hotel in Oman. I remember them arriving. There was a great convoy of the Arabs, firing into the air with the AK-47s and cheering and shouting, and upturned these coach loads of bedraggled, hungry, thirsty, filthy, dirty hostages who'd been in the desert for over 2 days, two nights. And my cameraman, who was a local cameraman, he was a local Jordanian, at least I thought he'd be, he was Jordanian, said to me, I want to go and film the aircraft again. And I said, I've had enough of it. We've got plenty of footage of the aircraft. He said, no, I must go back. And I said, well, you go back. You don't need me. But he did, because he wouldn't get through the military O-blocks without my press pass. So I reluctantly agreed to go back with him out into the desert. And he started filming. And I said, look, forget it. We've got as much film as we need of these. And he just ignored me. And obviously from a signal that I didn't see, he zoomed in, and as he did, the first of the aircraft exploded. The VC-10 of BOAC just exploded in front of us. And the others went up behind it, the Swiss Air, an American. And I thought, how did he know? And he said, well, I'm a member of the PFLP, unknown to us. We thought he was just a Jordanian lawyer, but he was also a member of the PFLP, and he'd been told to go back to film it. Now, that was great news for us, being a callous journalist. It was just astonishing pictures to see these aircraft going up, and it was exclusive to us. So I said, well, let me have the film, we'll get it out to Beirut. He said, no, this belongs to the PFLP. And of course, that was why they'd sent him back. They wanted documented proof, historical evidence of what they'd done. And it took us a long, long time, and my producer David Phillips had to negotiate for a long time to eventually get this small roll of silent footage from the PFLP. Then, of course, the nightmare of getting it out of Oman with the airport closed. To anywhere. So David, while I was carrying on interviewing people and doing my story about the release of the hostages in the hotel, getting interviews with everybody, David went to the airport and found it empty, except for one caravel that was parked. And he said to the airport superintendent, when is the next flight and where does it go? They said, well, there are no flights. He said, what about this aircraft? He said, well, the crew have gone. And he said, well, how much will it cost me to hire this aircraft to fly me to Cyprus? And I think they said, I think it must have been $12,000 or $14,000, which in 1970 was an enormous sum of money. Of course, David had only a couple of thousand. But another old buddy of mine called Bert Quint of CBS News was also at the airport filming. And Sutton was brought into the negotiations. And of course, being American and CBS, he was loaded. And so they counted out $12,000, $14,000. They brought the crew back, and David was the only passenger with this small roll of silent footage to arrive in Cyprus. And it was on the air that night, on ITN, that same night. Great, great scoop. I think one of ITN's greatest. So that was how we got the VC-10 and those aircraft blowing up on Dawson's Field. But then, of course, I had to get my story out, which is the larger story of the release of the hostages, their interviews, and everything else. So the next day, I go to the airport, get the first of the scheduled flights out to Beirut, feeling pretty happy with things, and to be confronted by a pretty hostile American producer and his camera.